Well, thank you very much, Hugh. It's really a great pleasure to be here. And I would like to start giving you a very global view of how nuclear receptors, in particular in the case of retinoic acid receptors, are supposed to work and what kind of questions we want actually to address. Let me start with the first question, which is one of the key issues of biology. And that is, we would like to understand how complex systems are set up from individual cells. As you all know, following the fertilization of an oocyte by a sperm, there's a complex process which is initiated, leading to an embryo with different tissues, high complexity. And what we know is that this process is entirely autonomously regulated by the genetic information which is in the fertilized zygote. This involves regulation of cell multiplication, cell diversification, the formation of organs, and in the adult, the regulation of the homeostasis that the body functions properly. As I said, all of these processes are controlled by the system itself. And this control involves quality functions. In case cells don't meet the quality standards, nature simply decides to eliminate them, either by the immune system or by committing suicide autonomously in the cells. And what we would like to understand is the principles which govern these processes. And recently, there have been quite some advances in the fields, because we know that even in vitro you can generate even complex structures, like structures which resemble organs. We call them organoids. So you may have heard, even in the lay press, that there has been the generation of mini brains. So these are structures which have generated from individual cells, from stem cells or from induced pluripotent cells, and which resemble brains. That, of course, has implication for regenerative medicine, but I'm not going further into that. So at the end point of this development, what we have is a highly dynamic adult body, like the one you can see here, which is actually composed of 37 trillion cells, which are properly well organized. What is important to know that even at this stage, there's an extremely high dynamics in this body, because every day there are between 40 and 50 billion cells who die, and every second there are 5 million cells which are newly generated. Of course, most of those are hematopoietic cells, because these ones have a high turnover, but even in other organs there is a significant turnover of cells. So this has actually led to a fundamental statement from Christiane Nüßlein-Vollert. He actually got the Nobel Prize for developmental biology in Drosophila, and she said, one of the most profound questions in nature is how complexity arises from initial simplicity. That is to say, how can we understand that from a single fertilized oocyte, such complex structures are generated? So as you all know, the basic principle of body organization is the generation of cell lineages which are committed and which adopt certain fates. Like here in the hematopoietic systems, you have precursors, hematopoietic stem cells. Then there are molecular decisions, and this is the important point, certain types of molecular decisions which lead to a distinction between myeloid precursors, lymphoid precursors, and then the chain of specialization or differentiation continues, such that at the end you have fully functional, diverse sets of cells which can adopt in the body a certain function. Now, you can place that differently in order to understand how these processes can evolve. And what is very often used is the Waddington landscape, which places the stem cell like a ball which runs along certain furrows and adapts a certain type of differentiation. This has been often taken as an example of epigenetics, because it's supposed to resemble epigenetic traits, epigenetic structures, but we know now that these landscapes, which by the way can lead to pathological situations in case that a decision occurs, for example, a mutation in this factor, which leads him to a different path, and then disease is generated. And I think you all are aware of that, and we'll hear about that. A prime example is what Hug is studying, is the APL, where you have a fusion of PML and RA, and this leads to an aberrant generation of a landscape, which then creates pathological disease, in this case of cancer. Now, these landscapes, they are regulated by a mutual interaction between various regulatory principles. There is signaling. This can be signaling by nuclear receptors, by hormones, but also by other types of environmental signals or metabolic signals. The readout is the transcriptome, but there is an impact from the epigenetics. And finally, we are, for over the last 10 years or 15 years or so, we are getting more and more aware of the impact of the structure of chromatin within the nucleus itself, which contains apparently genetic information or topologically encoded genetic information. So we have here a highly dynamic landscape, and all of these molecular decisions, they derive from the combinatorial action of all of these various levels of regulation. Now, the key element or the key step in all of these processes is what we call cell fate transitions. So if you remember the cell lineage which I showed you, you have a stem cell which then adopts a speciality. It goes into a certain pathway, and we have multiple pathways: adipogenesis, neurogenesis, hematopoiesis, myogenesis, but also pathological pathways like tumorigenesis. All of them are initiated by triggers. Triggers can be intra or extracellular cues, like morphogens, like all trans retinoic acid, but there can be also genetic events, like mutations, which then can lead to tumorigenesis. And all of this leads at the end to an altered cell identity with altered cell function. In the physiological cases, it's differentiation. In the pathological case, it's a transformation. But there can be many more different types of modifications, like transdifferentiation, dedifferentiation, and regeneration to a certain extent. The questions which are arising here are, what are the limits of the cell plasticity, and can we use these possibilities, for example, by recent technologies which have been developed for genome engineering? Can we use them to modulate pathology, or even use them to generate engineered tissue, or to understand pathologies which are linked to the organ itself? And in that respect, the generation of organoids is something which is rather exciting. So what we know in these processes are often some of the key players. So you may have heard MyoD is one of the key players. It's a transcription factor in myogenesis, but there are others which are key players. But these are also only individual names. And behind these names, there is an entire program. There's a gene network which is responsible to induce these complex events. And that is actually what is largely unknown, and what is the challenge, and what is what interests us. So in order to study cell fate in our lab, we have to reduce our ambition. We cannot take the entire zygote and then go to an intact animal. But we are reducing our ambition to certain model systems. So we take stem cells, for example, mouse F9, P19, or embryonic stem cells. F9 are teratocarcinoma cells, but they are already predestined to go into a particular differentiation. And P19, for example, are cells which we use a lot in order to study neuronal differentiation. And we try to understand what are the processes which drive these differentiations, and as a trigger, and that is why I'm here, we use retinoic acid. because retinoic acid is a fantastic trigger to initiate differentiative events at various levels, and we use that because we are working for quite some time with this. So our approach is an integrative study of genome-wide changes in gene expression as a consequence of the action of transcription factors, changing in the epigenome, and changes in chromatin structure. The technologies we use are standard. We use transcription profiling, chromatin immunoprecipitation, followed by high-throughput sequences to identify transcription factor binding sites globally or the structure of the epigenome. We use FairSeq. There are other technologies like ATAC-seq, but we find FairSeq quite useful in order to study chromatin accessibility. You know, DNA is impacted in chromatin, and there are regions which are more or less open and accessible, for example, to transcription factors or other regulatory machineries. And this accessibility is a very good readout, for example, for cell identity and for the possibility in this particular cell to regulate a particular genetic loci. And then we are using the Hi-C technology in order to study the three-dimensional organization of chromatin in the nucleus. We need for all of this bioinformatics analysis. We have gone through very painful phases in which we had to recognize that data which are out there are not necessarily very reliable, that there are limitations in the quality of data sets. We are talking here about data sets which are 5 gigabytes each individual experiments. And we have actually set up portal which is freely available to the scientific community in which you can study and access the quality of your own data or of those data which are out there. And we have a quality assessment scheme so that you can really pick those experiments which are of high quality. And this is for ChIP-seq or for Hi-C analysis. Now, then we have to develop tools to integrate the existing knowledge. For example, a lot of people, or not so many, but there are some very good studies on transcription factor target gene interactions, which you don't have to repeat yourself, so you integrate them in order to interpret your data, which, by the way, says it's important that these are very well quality-wise set up. Because if the quality is not at a high standard, you cannot use these data. And this is actually something which is missing in the field, and there is something which the field has to wake up and to put much more quality controls than what is currently done, especially by the big consortia. So then what you generally want to do is generate a gene regulatory network. And we are trying to do that also with existing tools. We have developed then what we call a signal propagation tool, and this will become clearer while I'm talking, in order to identify in these various pathways who are the master switches or the key regulators. And those are then the candidates which you can test, and those are the factors which are interesting actually to modulate for studying their impact also on pathology or if you want to study diseases, for example, in organoids. Some of the tools have to be improved. They were out there like a normalization tool, and we have spent quite some time to optimize that. And at the end, we had to develop also tools in order to integrate the information which we get from the 3D chromatin organization into the networks without even knowing what kind of transcription factors are there. But this will become clearer while I'm going ahead. So at the end, when you have such a network, you see the goal is to have a network which visualizes actually the transition which is underlying a differentiation phenomenon or a pathological phenomenon. Once you have that, you have to you validate it. This can be done by bioinformatics, but bioinformatics on its own, of course, in a biological system does not tell you everything, so you need experimental validation approaches as well. So let me go through a couple of levels now, how we try to construct at the end gene regulatory networks. The first step usually what we use is a tool which is called Dynamics Regulatory Event Miner. It is a complicated name for something very simple. You are looking at a time point zero. This time point zero, for example, is when we add retinoic acid. And then you make a transcriptome profile at 0 and 2 hours, and you compare the two. At 2 hours, you have certain gene programs activated, and the DREM now asks back, at this time, can we identify the corresponding transcription factor? Because we know, in principle, what transcription factor is activating which sets of genes, and can we identify what is happening, and can we correlate that with activation of transcription, no major change, or repression of transcription. And this is what is done by DREM. For example, this pathway is a pathway which is activated where retinoic acid receptors play a major role, but also HOX genes. On the other hand, there is a down-regulated gene where MYC plays a role. And then you go further, 2 hours to 6 hours, for example, you ask what is different between these two? Is there a point of divergence? And this is what we call a decision point. So everything which is here in green is a decision or bifurcation point where new pathways are generated. And at this 2 hours, for example, there is a repressed profile, a pattern of genes which stays repressed here. And it's interesting to see that there are many pluripotency genes, because obviously when you differentiate cells, you don't want to keep the pluripotency genes. You have to repress them because you do the opposite of pluripotency. And then there is another set of genes which slowly gets activated. Now, this seems to be a bioinformatic playing around, but it's not without meaning. Because when you then compare the various paths which are generated by this DREM and the corresponding transcription regulators, and you go into a clustering process in order to see what kind of gene ontology terms are related to these various clusters, you see that there are different types of functionalities which show up. For example, just here is the pathway 5 is highly related to regulation of cell cycle progression. So this means that the retinoic acid, which we initially give here, induces a set of events governed by downstream transcription factors, which at the end, each of them or each set of them generates functions which are, let's say, subprograms. And these subprograms together reconstitute or are a readout of what retinoic acid initially does. So initially it's a trigger, and then various programs are initiated. Now, the next step you would like to understand is the epigenetics. What is the corresponding of epigenetics to these paths? And if we look on this path 1, for example, and compare in all of the genes which constitute this path 1, the epigenetic profile. So here we look on H3K27 trimethyl, which is a repressive mark, K4 trimethyl, which is a positive mark linked to promoters which are activated, and we compare that to the gene expression profile, which is in green here, or the association of RNAs polymerase 2. You see that all of the genes in the path 1, the activated one, they are characterized by a decrease, which is here, this black shadowed area, a decrease of the repressive epigenetic mark, and a rather rapid increase of the positive mark for transcription regulation. You would expect that now from all of what we know. So we were not too surprised about that. We were also not surprised about the late response, which is shown here. And by the way, I forgot to say here, we are comparing two different cell lines. This is the F9 cell, which is going in the endodermal direction, and this is P19, which is going in the neuronal direction. You see already that the paths themselves are very different. So the decision points differ depending on what kind of organ retinoic acid is inducing. So back to this late path 4, for example, there you see that over up to 24 hours, basically nothing happens, and then the K27 goes down and the K4 goes up. So this explains why this is a late activated gene path, because this is actually what the epigenetic, you can say, dictates or correlates with. The next question you would like to understand, because this was rather global, what is happening at the individual target genes? So you want to identify retinoic acid, binds to a retinoic acid receptor, what are now the targets to which it binds? And there we use ChIP-seq, FAIR-seq for accessible chromatin, and then we use particular chemical ligands which address the individual subtypes of the retinoic acid receptor. I have to tell you that retinoic acid receptor is not a single receptor, but it's actually a dimer of RXR and RAR. And on top of it, there are three RXRs, alpha, beta, gamma, and three RARs, alpha, beta, gamma. So what we are doing is we use RAR selective ligands and compare them with all transretinoic acid. So ATRA is all transretinoic acid. Then here we use the F9 cells and we activate them. I can't read it properly, but I guess this is the gamma receptor, the alpha, the gamma ligand, alpha ligand, and the beta ligand. Now what you see immediately, this is the activation pattern of genes, is that there are very different responses to alpha, beta, and gamma, arguing also that these receptors have different consequences for gene activation. For example, if you look on HOXA1, one of the very early detected genes, HOXA1 doesn't care whether it's ATRA, alpha, gamma, alpha, or beta-specific ligand. It activates all the things. Whereas, for example, Jun and SOX2, they are responding particularly to ATRA, and they are responding to the gamma, but not to the alpha and the beta ligand. So there's selectivity involved. And what you can see here are all transcription factors. So this means these transcription factors, they follow a particular rule to be activated, and of course, then they activate their downstream genes. So this says, just as a sidestep, that ATRA itself is activating many more genes or regulating many more genes than, for example, the alpha. Here we are looking on the neuronal cell differentiation, so P19 cells. P19 cell differentiation is driven by the alpha ligand. So the alpha ligand here activates about 44% of all of the genes which are activated by all transretinoic acid, but it is sufficient in order to drive neurogenic differentiation. Whereas here we have the beta drives only 0.7% of the genes, and the gamma drives 1.8% of the genes, which says that retinoic acid is doing much more than just in these cells driving phenotypic differentiation or differentiation according to transcription factor activation. And the same is true for the F9 cells, which are shown here. So retinoic acid is doing more than the selective ligands. What this says is, the message here is, there's first a program of transcription factors which is induced by retinoic acid. Then these transcription factors can induce their cognate gene programs. And the other information is the native hormone has a much broader spectrum than the selective ligands. Now, the subsequent step is that you would like to generate what you see here, which is kind of a network. And in order to generate this network, it's not sufficient to know retinoic acid receptor binding to all of these target genes. We've done that by ChIP-seq and can identify them. But you would like to know if there is a transcription factor activated here, for example, what are the subsequent steps and how can we regenerate a complete network out of this information. For that, There was in 2014 a rather a major effort where people have profiled a large number of cells without going into details. They have established gene regulatory networks from these transcriptomic data, and they have validated them with other data which are out there on ChIP-seq, for example, from the ENCODE consortium. So these data, you don't have to regenerate yourself, you just take them. They are a mask which you put on your own data set and you merge everything, but this is not sufficient. That is why we had originally, for a completely different reason, generated a database in which we look for quality profile, for the quality of ChIP-seq profiles, and we have enlarged that to virtually all existing ChIP-seq profiles in the world. So currently these are 57,000 profiles. Everybody can look at these profiles and look on their quality. And we use this, we take what we call AAA profiles, which are the highest reliable profiles, and we integrate those information, because this is information on a transcription factor binding to a particular target gene. So all of this we take and integrate it in our database, and this is what comes out at the end without connectivity. You see that when you, so AREXA means ARIA AREXA, we just profile AREXA for simplicity, but what it means, there is a gene program in P19 which initiates a set of transcription factors that are specific for P19, and then a set of other genes which are depicted here, which are the consequence of the retinoic acid action on the transcription factors and the action of these transcription factors, which then generates this gene regulatory program, which is globally depicted here. Now, what is important is that besides or apart from this P19 specific program, there is also a program which is in common with the other cell differentiation system. Here we are talking about F9. They are not going to neuron direction. They are going into the direction of endodermal differentiation. And they have their own F9 specific program. But both of these, the P19 and the F9, or the neuronal and the endodermal, they share common programs. They share even common transcription factors which drive this program. So the first conclusion which we can derive from here is that the regulatory network, which is composed of a significant number of genes here, we call them nodes, and of connectivities, so we have something like 44,000 connectivities, they represent a mixture of common and fate-specific programs which are initiated by retinoic acid. I would call that as an example of multitasking of transcription factors. So nature uses transcription factors not only for one program, also for another program where it is useful, so the resources are very elegantly shared. And this is when you add the connectivities into the gene regulatory network, where you see certain sets of genes which drive particular functionality. Without going too much into detail, there are pluripotency factors which are depicted here. And these pluripotency factors, they are repressed in general, whereas a class of Hox factors, they are activated, as well as the neuronal specific markers. So these are cell-specific activated, regulated genes, and here are also cell-specific regulated genes, but these are markers for endodermal differentiation. So this is a network which is established without putting temporal information in there. But as you know, aging, development, everything is a vector, so we have to put in temporal information. And what you can see here, for example, is just a series of snapshots of gene activation or gene regulation. So activation is always red, repression is green, and you see the programs which are activated, either the P19 or the F9, over time. And indeed, what you can see when you list all of those is that in the P19 cells, for example, the common regulatory pathways. Initially, they make a large portion in, at time point two, but over time, the common pathway decreases in prevalence, and the F9 or P19 specific programs, they increase in significance. So these are the blue ones. This makes sense. You use a common system and then you specify over time this specific system. Now, I didn't tell you one particular point. As I said, we integrated information from this study from Cayenne in 2014, but this information was not on P19 or F9 cells. This was a variety of cells. So what we had there was the possibility that a transcription factor could activate a gene. And we said, actually in response to one of the reviewers who looked at this paper, we said, we have to have a tool by which we can confirm actually that what we put in is not just bioinformatics and you know, mixing and merging of data, but they have a biological sense. So what we developed is a tool in which we ask in the initial queue, if the initial queue is activated, so we digitalized this information. This is a, let's say, a gene regulatory event. Plus one means the gene is activated. Zero means it's unresponsive, and minus one, it's repressed. So we just made a bioinformatic tool which goes in a temporal fashion. So we go at time point two, time point, no, these are the different time points, one, two, three, and four. And at the end, we have the total readout of the fully differentiated cells. And we ask, is the information which we have put into the network, okay, is this meaningful with respect to the transcriptomes which we have developed for these two cell lines? And then we can exclude a certain number of genes, and using this, we have reduced our initial data from 2,900 to 1,900 genes which have a connectivity which is now meaningful and adapted to the cell line. Now, this tool, which we call Tetramer, has another advantage. Actually, what we can do is we can say we hypothetically activate a gene at a particular time point and look how much of the final program it does constitute. And by this, you can identify what we call master regulators, because if this is a majority of the final regulated gene program, then this initial activated gene, this is just bioinformatically active, it must be a master regulator. So we did that, and we asked, for example, which kind of genes are capable of initiating what percentage of the final program. So here, the top candidate was actually GBX2. GBX2, if we activate it like this, it will reconstitute more than 86% of the initial program. The same is TAL2 or TSH1 or this nuclear receptor here, which I think, I don't know which one it is. So there we have an additional possibility, and this is over a temporal time frame. So this is the 72 hours. So we have the possibility to identify novel genes, which even though people have looked a lot on neurogenic differentiation, these genes have not actually been identified before, or were only partially subscribed, like the TAL2 and the others which are illustrated here. So the next issue is then, can we, this is a visualization of some of these master regulators. GBX2, for example, is activated by a retinoic acid receptor, which is there. And then you see over the time how it regulates other transcription factors, which then exert their job. So can we validate that? For this, we use a technology which is called CRISPR-A, which is simply, not simply, but we had the challenge not to add exogenous genes, but we want it to activate endogenous genes. So what we do is we target with the guide RNA a Cas9, which is enzymatically inactive, but linked to VP64, which is an activation domain. We target that to a particular site in the genome and ask whether this is actually sufficient to activate a program. The first results were rather depressive, because when we did that, there was no response of the cells. And then we ask going back to what we have learned, there was this common program which was activated. Do we need this common program in addition? And in order to activate the common program, we went into, these are now F9 cells. These are P19 cells, which as control cells, not differentiated. So we activated them with a retinoid, which is activating the common program, but not the neurogenesis itself. So we use the one from the endodermal differentiation. This is the gamma-specific 961. And with the gamma-specific 961 together, then activating TAL2, GBX2, LHC2, and these factors, we get neuronal differentiation in these P19 cells, as you can see here by the TUCH1 and the MAP2 markers. And here's a blow-up of these experiments where you can really see that it's indeed the axonal projections which are stained. Now, this asks us, and I think I will stop after this, this asks us, can we artificially generate neurons out of cells which don't want to get neurons? I told you F9 cells, we add retinoic acid, they get endodermal cells. And so what we want to do is to take F9 cells and then a cocktail of master regulators from the neuronal pathway, activate them endogenously, and try to get a neuronal cell fate out of that. And indeed, it worked. So first, what we checked, whether we can use with the CRISPR activation technology and activate the endogenous genes, and you can see with different efficiency, we can discuss if you wish why, that indeed we can activate these genes. And the readout of the genes is actually, so if we look on various markers of differentiation, we can activate indeed with these different factors this pathway. And what you see here is now where we use a mix of these different CRISPR-targeted activation systems. And we are looking here at F9 cells, which are endodermal cells, which have now acquired a neuronal differentiation pathway, because SOX1, Nestin, MAP2 are activated in addition to TUCH1. So with that, I think I will skip this part on the chromatin, which we have investigated as well. Basically, suffice it to say that we have been able to identify by Hi-C which chromatin structures are driving now in a very remote fashion, so in mega bases away, certain target genes, and we can actually integrate this to get now what we call an EGRN, an extended GRN, where we have not only put in the nodes, the transcription factors themselves and the target genes, but also the genomic platforms, and we can associate these genomic platforms, which are now regions, you can say enhancer regions or open chromatin regions, with certain features of their epigenetic makeup, of the binding of retinoic acid receptor and of open chromatin. And all of this together we can integrate in such a huge map, which is illustrating what is happening during cell differentiation using the tools for the genomic tools which we have available and which I have described to you. Well, with this, I just want to point out the key people in this work have been Marco Mendoza-Para, who is one of the senior scientists in the lab, and Valeria Malisheva, who is now at the Brabham Institute, and she did a huge amount of work helping to set up the high C technology and to develop the bioinformatics together with a bioinformatician. And this has been a huge amount of work, and I'm very grateful to those, as well as to the bioinformaticians. This is Matthias Blum, and Pierre-Étienne Chollet should be, well, he's here. And without these bioinformaticians, we would not have been able to treat this data properly. Thank you for your attention.